On the programme, English poet PJ Kavanagh on his writing, his Irish connections and meeting his County Monaghan namesake. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. English poet PJ Kavanagh has created a memorable and distinctive body of work over more than five decades. His poetry is marked by a mastery of form, a strong sense of spiritual searching and celebration of nature and rural life, and a subtle, sometimes unexpected, use of rhyme and rhythm. His poems somehow manage to praise life and people while retaining a keen and often quizzical edge. Reviewing Kavanagh's work, Derek Mann said that if description is revelation, his revelatory gift is prodigious, but it is not strained. While Peter Levy in The Spectator said Kavanagh has written at least half a dozen poems on the shortlist for immortality. PJ Kavanagh has strong connections to this country and has made a number of literary links and friendships in Ireland. His Traveller's literary companion, Voices in Ireland, is an essential guide to Irish landscape through the written word and the literary imagination. Kavanagh has also published several novels, is an astute and respected literary critic and columnist, and his memoir, The Perfect Stranger, is regarded as a classic account of love, loss and enduring belief. PJ Kavanagh was in Ireland recently and we met and spoke of poetry and many things, beginning with his family connections to this country.
Well, my mother was supposed to have been born in County Roscommon. She certainly came over from Scotland to holidays there. But when my father tried to get her a pension when she reached the age, he said, "You'll be pleased to hear you've never been born, because no records." I think because, was it the courts, the four courts, lost a lot of things. But I think she was born in Ruskie. And my father's people came from Carlow, but he was born in New Zealand. And I was brought up really more Irish than the Irish, in effect. But I was born in England and I'm English.
Were you born with stories, or were you brought up with stories of Ireland?
Kevin Barry and all that sort of stuff, yes.
So you knew the terrain before you ever set foot in the country?
Very much so. And then I had to do national service and was posted to... I was in the Inniskilling Fusiliers and was posted to Northern Ireland, obviously, to Ballykindler, where there was absolutely nothing to do. And there I volunteered for career to get out of Northern Ireland. But anyway, my father was down south and my first time I ever stepped foot in the Republic was to meet my father and his great friend Jimmy O'Dea in a pub.
In a pub in Dublin?
Yes.
Do you have any memories of O'Dea and that encounter? I mean, a legendary figure in Dublin theatrical circles.
Oh, I do indeed. I'd be about 10 when I first met him. The BBC, my father worked for the BBC and wrote scripts for the BBC. And the BBC, his department was evacuated to North Wales, and we stayed in a place called Llanfairpwllgwyngyllgogerychwyrn. And Jimmy O'Dea came over with packets of tea sewn into the inside of his trousers, because tea was very short in England. Anyway, we went to Mass on a Sunday, which was given by an old Franciscan who arrived on a little motorbike, and it took place in the amusement park on Llanfairpwllgwyngyllgogerychwyrn Pier. And I was sitting next to Jimmy O'Dea, and I found him in tears, laughing, on his knees in tears rolling down his face. But he nudged me and pointed, and the Franciscan was hearing confessions on the rifle shooting range, which had above it, "The attendant's decision is final."
That's one way of putting it, all right. Over the years, again, you've written many poems about Ireland, about place, people, your ancestors, and that sense of connection, I suppose, a sense of being an insider and outsider at times.
That's both. But I, for some reason, I really do instinctively feel more at home in Ireland than I do in England.
Do you have any idea why?
I think I've always felt a foreigner in England. There's a kind of bantering humour, I suppose, which I go in for, which isn't quite English. I don't mean the English sort of humourless, as the Germans are reputed to be. I don't know whether they are or not. Not a bit. But even at school, I was always regarded as Irish. I was supposed to be good at rugby because I was Irish, and I was supposed to be funny because my father was funny and I was Irish, and so on. It's just an imprint. And I do feel at home in Ireland. Whether I feel at home in present-day Ireland, I don't know. I find it much changed. It was when I first knew it in the 50s, it was picturesque, but picturesque in the countryside, I mean. Picturesque usually means poor, doesn't it? And it's not so poor now, thank goodness. Anyway, it became richer. And people riding on fast asleep on carts pulled by donkeys and that sort of thing. It was still going on in the 50s, but it's certainly not going on now.
Yeah, so richer, but perhaps not quite so picturesque. poems like Boris House, Conte yeah. Carlo, explore something of that sense of connection. Maybe you'd read that poem for us.
OK, well, what happened was my great-grandfather, I suppose, would be left Boris in County Carlo, and his descendants, presumably therefore my grandfather and various uncles and cousins, always claimed, this is in Tasmania, he went to Tasmania incidentally under his own volition. It would have been much easier to track him if he'd gone as a convict, but he didn't. He had Catholic connections there through Cardinal Cullen, or the man who became Cardinal Cullen. They always muttered that, they came from the big house, of course, like all colonials do. My father barely mentioned it. McMurray Kavanagh was supposed to be called, but he didn't call himself McMurray Kavanagh. And I read a book. I decided to find out whether there was any truth in it, among other truths, any truth in that. And previously, I got in touch with Andrew Kavanagh, who's head of the Kavanagh clan, was very hospitable. And I went there to Boris House, and I may say, no record could be found of any connection at all. But there might be. There might be. And so I read a poem called Boris House, County Carlo. Ancestor hunting, an interest as sudden as middle age. As though I thought a chain of farmers, post office keepers, castle holders, bog kings, knackers, farmers' workers, traitors, clanked at my heel. I did find one, great-grandfather, an old grandee or a great liar. French Jacobins making thought a thing to fear, what did they do, those summits of others' labour, behind high walls, the nearest speakable neighbour, sodden, impassable Irish miles away? In 98, some flogged the blacksmiths, busy, essential men, with a ring of lingering magic round their craft. Here, 10 were chained to the wine cellar walls in dark. The benches they sat on crumble away to cork. And out of the 10, for death, one was chosen. Perhaps he had made pikes for the rebellion. Perhaps not. Examples must be made, possessions held. Perhaps. In recent years, over a bottle of wine, the rate assessor faced the heir, his business done. Your ancestor, he said, killed one of mine. That was a just fight, cruelly put down. The wall still stands, the length of the little town, whichever side of it, 20 years later, he was born. An embattled grandee or great liar? Not a man, but knows both titles privately, his own.
P.J. Kavanagh, that poem in a way reminds me of something you quoted in a column in the TLS some years ago. You quoted Cheslow Miwash saying that the voice of a poet should be purer and more distinct than the noise or confused music of history. And I suppose in a sense, in a poem like that, you're searching for a certain truth of history and accepting that we may never know the truth, and yet poetry may help us to reach to at least some kind of common humanity through history.
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah. Yes.
You were named Patrick Kavanagh, of course, the great Monaghan poet, shared the name. Did you know him?
He is a great poet, I think. Yes. I met him twice, and the first time it was before he was really known in England, and I'd be about 20, I suppose, and I was a great admirer of The Great Hunger, his poem. And I was introduced to him, taken at the... Patrick said, a man, come and meet Paddy Kavanagh. And I went, he just had a throat operation. And I went up humbly to congratulate him, but he drew away and said, why don't you change your fucking name? And that's the only thing he ever said to me, really. But that's why, as a writer, I call myself P.J. Kavanagh, in a sometimes vain attempt to distinguish myself from him. And then I met him later, bumped into him in a pub with John Jordan, the distinguished John Jordan, who was a great friend of his. And again, he wouldn't speak to me. And John Jordan got very angry with him and said, Paddy, this is a friend of mine, and he's a good man, you must talk to him. He said, no. And so I said to John, well, what should I do? He said, buy him a brandy. So I bought him a brandy, but he remained standing with his back to me, but his hand cupped out behind the small of his back for the brandy. And that was the last I saw of Patrick Kavanagh. But I'm a great admirer of his.
The backwards grip, and he took the brandy.
He took the brandy, but without turning round.
He didn't look you in the eyes. You had another encounter then, I think, on the Canal Bank seat, Kavanagh's seat, here in Dublin, where you were sitting one morning.
Yes, I was sitting next to the statue of Kavanagh. Is it by Baggot Street Bridge, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And a woman went by with a small child, and she said to the child, now, say good morning to Mr. Kavanagh, meaning to the statue, and there was a live Mr. Kavanagh sitting there, which I thought was rather charming.
Say good morning to the poet.
Yeah.
I think you were an occasional visitor to MacDade's, the famous Dublin literary pub of the 50s, 60s, 70s. Do you have particular memories of that place?
Well, not really. I used to go a lot with Pierce Hutchinson there, and I remember we met the poet Paul Durkin there. I remember a high ceiling. Was it a sort of repository for the dead originally? It seemed like a mortuary, but very lively.
A lively mortuary.
But when I came back to Dublin next, I think it had either changed or gone or whatever. No, I used to meet Pierce Hutchinson in Slattery's in Rathmines.
When and where did you meet Pierce Hutchinson?
In Barcelona in the mid-1950s. And immediately the Irish thing came out. We bonded, I suppose is the word, at once. And he used to, he encouraged me. He was older than me, but not significantly. I think it was only about 4 years, something like that. But that's quite a lot in your mid-20s and someone in the late-20s who had published poems. He hadn't published a book then, I don't think. But he published poems in Irish, certainly. And anyway, we grew very fond of each other and remained so to the day of his death. But he was quite firm. I remember I once wrote a poem I showed him called Song, and he said, can you sing it? And I hadn't really thought of that, and I realised I couldn't. But on the whole, he was very encouraging, and he used to leave new poems of his written out in his particularly beautiful, careful handwriting. When I was out, he left them on the table of the lodgings I had in Barcelona. We had that sort of relationship.
And together, I think you organised the first public readings of poetry in Catalan by self-proclaimed Catalan poets in an era when Franco was all-powerful and he was no supporter of the regional languages identities of Spain. That must have been quite a moment, though you might not have been so aware of it at the time.
Pierce knew how big a moment it was, because one of Pierce's obsessions, you could call it, and a justified one, was hatred of any sort of bullying or tyranny, but also the imposition of censorship on a smaller language. And the language there was Catalan, and Catalan writers were really not allowed to, barely allowed to publish, certainly not allowed to meet. And I think Pierce suggested, because he knew a lot of Catalan poets, quite elderly ones, I think, and I was working for the British Council then, and we arranged, and I think it was the first time they'd ever been together in a public building reading their poems. And I suppose if the British Council had realised as indeed I did not either, how this could be interpreted as a form of subversiveness. I don't know. I didn't know. I've been given great credit for organising this, but I really didn't know how unusual or dangerous it was. But it was greatly appreciated.
You yourself use rhyme, sometimes very intricate internal rhymes. I mean, you seem to work very hard at the craft of poetry, and I wonder if that's something very important for you, to work almost daily at the craft as well as honouring the gift of it.
Well, I always like to feel... Oh, it's a ridiculous analogy, but I always like to feel a poem is a piece of carpentry, and if it all clicks together and the drawers come in and out and it works, you've made something. It stands. It doesn't rock on its feet. And I think I'm insufficiently confident to try free verse, which somebody described, Robert Frost described as playing tennis without a net. I think it's a rather good idea to have a net to set oneself a problem. And it's amazing how that problem sometimes helps you make the poem. I was very early on, I was a great disciple of a great piece of furniture maker, the poet Louis MacNeice, another Irishman, whom I got to know at one stage. And I delight in his cleverness with rhyme and pattern and so forth. And I think I've always felt more confidence if I was writing within a frame.
Do you write every day?
I did. Prose as well. I read novels and other things. Yes, I think you've got to do that. But I haven't now for... Well, I keep a journal. Or indeed, I kept a journal until about a year ago. I find the words don't come so sparkling from the tap as they used to. As I thought they were.
You'll be aware of the huge sense of loss here at the recent death of Seamus Heaney.
Yep.
A sense of national mourning, really, and a reminder of the central place of the poet and poetry within the Irish spirit, within Irish culture. Mm-hmm. You knew Seamus Heaney. I think you invited him to the Cheltenham Festival many years ago.
Yes, I did. And he stayed with us and stayed subsequently too, and I've had many letters from him. I was very fond of him. He was a very easy man to like. But he, again, is an exemplar of form. There's not much that, if you look at it carefully, it's sewn together, really, quite exquisitely.
And I think he wrote some poems for you as well. When he stayed, he wrote out...
Oh, yes, I read a poem about the elder tree, which is much despised in England. It's regarded as a sort of weed. And I'm very fond of elder trees because of their berries and their flowers and their... In fact, if you burn an elder tree, you see the devil. It's associated with many idiotic superstitions. And he had written a poem about an elder tree called The Boer Tree, because they're called boer trees, I don't know why, in Northern Ireland anyway. In the Republic, I don't know.
Yes, too.
Yeah. And suddenly he sort of took out an old typewriter of ours, a portable, and started typing out his boer tree poem for us and then correcting it by hand. And I thought, this is a very competitive man. I think he actually was a competitive man. Nothing wrong with that, really. I don't think it was competition in this case. And I realised years later that it was a form of gift that I could dispose of and sell or something. And, of course, I didn't crumple it up and throw it away, but I've lost it long ago. I didn't keep it. I hadn't understood his generosity in doing this.
You mentioned MacNeice there as well,
yeah.
And you said you got to know him.
Yeah.
Any particular memories of encounters with him or moments of shared poetry?
Well, I don't know about moments of shared poetry. He worked for the BBC, as did my father, and my father introduced me to him, and I was enchanted. I hadn't met... I was thinking, you know, I wanted to be a poet. Could I be a poet? Would I write poems? And he certainly had. And a very attractive man, because he had this, what I can only call laugh wrinkles, sort of four or five wrinkles at the outside corners of his eyes, which made him look as though he was always smiling, always laughing. I always find that very attractive. little words from somebody you admire can be so useful. He was buying a round of drinks in the BBC pub, the Stag, I remember. Again, I was a starstruck 20-year-old. And he told me he was doing a radio series on Spencer's The Fairy Queen. And I pulled a face, as if to say, oh, gosh, how boring. I remember him turning round with this smiling. He said, it's not bad, you know. And I thought, yeah, and he's quite right. And then another day, I went in and he was there and he said to me, look, I can't think of anything more to say to these people. Let's go and watch some cricket at Lord's. Wow, marvellous. And so we got into a taxi at the expense of the BBC script department and arrived at Lord's. And I was in the Mayan stand at Lord's next to Louis Meknes after he had had quite a long session in the Stag, I suppose. And I thought, I must say something interesting. What the basis can I say that's interesting? And I was thinking this, and I found something mildly interesting, I imagine, turned to him and discovered he was fast asleep. And then he read to me in Java, he was putting together an anthology. He told somebody I heard on the grapevine that I was very promising, which helped me a lot, as a poet, I mean, and would I send a poem for this anthology he was doing. And I was in Java at the time. He chased me up to there. I was very encouraged by that. He was a good man.
The Perfect Stranger is the title of your memoir, first published in 1966 and reprinted more recently, a beautiful, haunting and, I suppose, haunted account of your love for and marriage to your first wife, Sally Phillips, who died too young. Where did that title, The Perfect Stranger, come from?
From Louis Meknes. Eclogue?
Yes.
What eclogue for Christmas, eclogue? And Can One Never Meet the Perfect Stranger? And I suddenly realised that was the title because I felt I had met the perfect stranger.
Tell me a little about her and about that time.
Well, I was teaching English at the University of Jakarta. I was working for the British Council. And well, there isn't really much to say. We were there for about a year and a half. And she'd be about 24 and a half. We went to Bali, had a marvellous time, and I think she picked up something there. And anyway, it was polio, and she died. And I came back home, and in the end, at a great loss, and went round various theatres, realised there was nothing I could do. I was useless at everything, except possibly acting. I'd done a lot of acting at university. In fact, I'd been rather a star actor at university. And so I went round various theatrical companies looking for jobs, and they all said, well, what experience have you had? And I'd say, well, acted at university. And they said, oh, really? How interesting. Goodbye. And eventually I got into one and became an actor for about 10 years. But I always knew that really I wanted to write. Being an actor was company, wonderful company, like being in a regiment in the army or a family. It was lovely.
So going into acting in a way was a search for family after such a great loss.
That's right.
And I suppose many people will remember you as an actor in the TV series Father Ted, with the great character of Father Seamus Fitzmaurice, the collector of Nazi memorabilia.
That was after I'd retired. That was for some reason my agent said they want you to do an audition for this part in Father Ted, which I'd never seen. And to my surprise, they started to laugh when I read the script and gave me the part. And it seems to me somebody is saying, Trim the other day, an Irish actor said to me, I saw you in Father Ted. I did an awful lot of other things than Father Ted, but my last appearance was obviously the one that struck home.
That must have been good fun to do, though.
The extraordinary thing about that, because I did a lot of television in the 60s and 70s, this was in the 90s, I suppose, was the care. It all looked as though we were making it up as it went along, but the director, it was polished to the last sentence, which there was no mucking about at all. It was almost like a military manoeuvre. It was brilliantly directed.
Coming back to, very briefly, to the death of your first wife.
Yeah.
Sally was the daughter of the novelist Rosamund Lehman and Wogan Phillips, and I think you stayed in touch with them after her death and your own second marriage to your wife Kate.
Oh, both of them, Rosamund and her father, yes. In fact, we went to move to the country in order to be near her father. He found a place. And I very much stayed a member of the family. And Rosamund was remarkably forgiving, considering I'd taken away her daughter and come back without her. Great friend.
You dedicated the poem Breakfast in Italy to the American poet John Berryman. And I'll ask you to read that in a moment. But uh-huh. Before you do, how did you get to know Berryman?
There was Giancarlo Menotti, opera writer, had a festival of poetry every year in a place called Spoleto, a beautiful place in Spoleto. And I was invited to go there, still rather a junior, partly because I knew one of the people who were running it, and he knew my work, but anyway, he was a friend. And there I met, just about everybody. Ezra Pound, the silent Ezra Pound. I've got their names now. Who were Allen Ginsberg and John Berryman, particularly because he was such a spectacular drunk, and he gave out tremendous howls of despair and so on in his drunkenness in company. And what was so funny was that Allen Ginsberg, in his robes and beads, full 1960s hippiedom, was very much followed about by the police in case he was using drugs, which he wasn't, certainly not at that time. So Alan, nice man that he was really rather a nuisance because the police were swarming around him. But anyway, he disapproved of the drunkenness. This is the irony. Disapproved of the drunkenness of Berryman and other contemporaries of Berryman. And he meant to be the great criminal, dopey, junkie, whatnot. I was walking him one day to the auditorium and he said, "Why must these academic poets be so goddamn intemperate?"
Oh, it's a good line, yes. Breakfast in Italy.
Mm. Well, I'm really, really repeating the story I've just told, in a sense. This was after I heard that Berryman had thrown himself off a bridge and thereby committed suicide. "Your words have gaps round. They work, John. You may be glad to hear so, Berryman. If you hear where you have gone, you hoped you might and jumped to darkness. In Italy, you said, 'Do you drink whiskey?' At 9 a.m., I answered, 'Yes, not now.' Your glass, the colour of tea, milkless. Afraid, all week I fled the continents of sweat with white encrusted coasts on your alpaca jacket. Propped by acolytes, your maniac howl at parties, I called a soul commercial. It sounded so. Now, at a pavement cafe, your whiskey in a tea glass, you half entrap me for a tale about the lie you made of three lives, one yours, for sake of love. Through memories you blink at morning traffic. I am a lost guest pretending to be host. You are clear inside a blurred ghost. So, you bless the passers. Now I drink, and wild horses wouldn't make me tell a lie. Hoisted over the street to buy your airline ticket, suddenly you turned and kissed me hard. I feel your dreadful beard even now. You learned such speed, John, when you wrote. Maybe a good man too, God knows. As a saint then, John, you were odd and quick to mark. Cunning it was, by grasp to name a trouble shared and generous. One who doubted, now no word against you hears. Self-pity for the tribe you wrote and showed.
Breakfast in Italy, read by the poet PJ Kavanagh, our guest on Arts Tonight. And we'll have more with him in a moment. Our guest on Arts Tonight is the poet PJ Kavanagh. I met Kavanagh on a recent visit to Dublin, and we talked about the Gloucestershire poet Ivor Gurney, who fought in the First World War, but was much more than a war poet. Kavanagh edited Gurney's collected poems, and he told me a little about his life and work.
Well, he's primarily a musician, started as a musician, and maybe what's interfered with his reputation, which is now very much on the increase, and he's in anthologies. Indeed, his name is inscribed in the walls of Westminster Abbey now, was people didn't believe that somebody could be a poet and a musician. He was not a successful composer, composer of music for songs. And also he wrote, especially during the Great War, poems about Gloucestershire and after the war, and he named the villages, and this that he loved. And although, in fact, this was in very general terms, they were generic villages, they were also specific villages, but it made people think he was a local poet. So he was not only a musician, a composer, and a poet, but a local poet, which is a poet of a locality, a particular locality, so that cut down. And then, of course, he started going a little bit mad. And so he was not only a local poet and a composer and musician, he was also a little bit mad, so really that shut him down for quite a long time. But there were, Edmund Blunden published a collection of his poems, and Leonard Clark, there were such, but they were rather bad for reasons too complicated to go into. And by chance, it's too long a story to tell, living in Gloucester as I do, I put on a little programme about Gurney, and a man rang me up and said, look, in the next door, Mrs. Gurney, Ivor's sister-in-law, lives, and she's got boxes and boxes of his notebooks. So I sped along there as fast as I could and managed to talk the nice Mrs. Gurney, the sister-in-law, into letting me have these boxes on loan on condition that when I'd finished with them, I took them to the archive of Gloucester Library, which indeed I did. But they stayed with me for 2 or 3 years. And then, for mysterious reasons, I was asked to edit by Oxford University Press his poems, whether the word had got around that I'd got these notebooks, or a friend of mine called Geoffrey Grigson, to whom I'd showed them, had recommended me, I don't know. I was given the job of editing a selection of his poems, which took me about 2 years. And I was given a £500 advance, I remember, and trying to earn my living at the same time. And once he had a great ego, Ivor, I suppose, like most poets, I don't know. And I once threw my hands up and stared at the ceiling through which I could not see the heavens, but I addressed the heavens and said, Ivor, Ivor, let me get spare. There were about 15 versions of one particular poem. Spare me, let me get on with my own work. And a voice came clear as a bell through the roof. Forget your own work, get on with mine.
Oh, the spirit spoke, and that book came out. Would you read one of his poems for us?
Well, I suppose he is a marvellous poet, sort of unlike anybody else, marvellous rhymer apart from anything else, a very daring rhymer. But it's only short, this particular poem, and I suppose it is his anthology piece. It's called Song. It's quite early. He was a Gloucestershire man, a great walker by night, and along the Severn and the hills above the Severn, above the Cotswolds, where I happen to live. And it's so simple and charming, this poem, that, and it is representative of him in a way, and it's only 8 lines long. And I think it's the only poem of his own which he set to music. He set other people's poems to music, but this is the only one of his own, called Song. Only the wanderer knows England's graces, or can anew see clear familiar faces. And who loves joy as he that dwells in shadows? Do not forget me quite. Those Seven Meadows.
And there's a beautiful simplicity and, yeah, and elegance in, yeah, in that poem, and strength. I mean, it's an extraordinary poem for such a brief lyric. What poets or poems do you read these times?
Well, oddly enough, I do read Gerard Manley Hopkins a lot, both for form and for invention and originality and mood and description. But I suppose what I really love and have affected me most are people like Henry Vaughan, and who very good at form, and George Herbert, and Andrew Marvell. They were would be the people I took to the desert island.
Many of your own poems explore themes of faith and doubt, of the struggle to perhaps to believe in the face of what life may thrust upon us.
Yeah.
Would you describe yourself as a Christian or a Roman Catholic? And I wonder,
both.
Sometimes see poetry as a form of prayer?
Well, yes. I wouldn't have thought of saying that, but I could accept that, I think. No, I think I'm very aware of what seems to me the loss of a sense of the supranatural and of there being something outside us. I've got friends, great friends, who, whenever I say there is anything outside us, you know, an inspiration, a grace, who get very angry. That's absolutely opposite to what they think. And they think they're rationalists, and they think that is a betrayal of the modern spirit, of the Enlightenment, if you like. But my life has been so full of what seems to me, one doesn't like to boast, and also they could go away or they could be meaningless, but sort of visitations of grace, really, far greater than myself. And I would like to remind people of the possibility of such things, because, and Seamus Heaney very much does the same thing. And to some extent, Louis MacNeice, son of a bishop. Not necessarily to confront what Yeats called the filthy modern tide, but to remind people that there are, and also a connection with nature as well, I think, but that's outside themselves as well. So I would describe myself as, in fact, I've recently been described by Derek Mahon as a cradle Catholic, which indeed I am.
As in Catholic from the word go.
Yeah.
But somebody, I mean, many cradle Catholics abandoned the cradle quite early on.
Yes.
And never returned
to
any form.
I went to a Benedictine boarding school, and it seems to me that it had very little effect on most of us.
I love that phrase you use, the visitation of grace.
Yeah.
And I thought, like you, I almost immediately thought of Heaney. And, for instance, in one of the late poems, I think it's in District Uncircled, there's a very beautiful image of a blackbird,
yes,
in the ivy.
It. That's right. Yes,
and
yes.
There, when he comes there, when he leaves, whatever. And it... Also in your poetry, in some of the nature poetry, for want of a better term,
yeah,
there is some sense of a kind of transcendence that we can witness in and through nature.
Yes.
Has that been a constant? I mean, you've farmed in Gloucestershire, is it fair to say that being close to the land, to nature, has been very important to you in your writing?
Oh, yes, very much so. I can't claim to be a farmer. I was just an incomer, fortunate enough to be an incomer. But selected poems of mine is coming out next year, and I thought of calling it Out of Reach. I was quite amazed when I went through my poems. The number of times I seem to be saying there is something there, even though it's out of reach, that doesn't mean to say it's not there. And I thought of calling the whole book Out of Reach. The publisher didn't like that idea. So I don't know what it'd be called, if anything, just selected poems. But it is a recurring theme, that there is something, but that it can't be touched, that it can't be made a fact, and doesn't prove that it doesn't exist.
I think you once quoted Jan Morris writing about this Celtic belief in another world just beyond the window, just outside the window vane.
And it is rather Irish, actually, isn't it? Yes.
Is that something you feel?
Yes.
And do you think it is particularly Celtic? And I mean, do you feel that it's within you?
I've never sat down saying, I must be Irish and believe in the fairies, that sort of thing. But I find in much of Irish literature always that, never mind, not necessarily Catholic by any means, this sense of, James Stevens is a great hero of mine, actually, but you can go down a hole in the ground and you'll start to talk to fairies, rather interesting talk with fairies. I would never do that, but anyway, he does it extremely well. And there is that feeling of contact with something outside.
And why not?
Why not?
Your 1994 book, Voices in Ireland, a Traveller's Literary Companion, is this wonderful guide to Ireland, a place seen through writers writing local literature, and I suppose the landscape as revealed through the eyes and witness of writers. You travelled all over the country for that book, for the making of that book.
Yes,
have been a great labour of love for you.
It was. Oh, it was fascinating. That again took 2 years, and Kate and I, my wife, she actually divided Ireland into 8, and she's a much more systematic mind than I have, and we scoured. It was always writers in their place. That was the Donny. That was what I was asked to do. If there was a writer, say Swift, and he mentioned the place, or even if he didn't actually, but anyway, was deeply connected with the place, one chose him or her. There were lots of women, although people complained there weren't enough. There were lots of women in it. To go around Ireland, having Ireland, which God knows to me is full enough of echoes and rhymes and allusions, and discover these extra echoes of the past in the words of the Irish writers, Irish or English writers, or foreign writers. There were foreign writers here. Heinrich Boll wrote a marvellous chapter about Limerick, for example, German. Even enhanced it more. In fact, to both of us, Ireland has become an even more magical place than it was when we began that book. The only sadness about that book is that I haven't read my contract. We found so much. And I quoted it. I mean, I didn't write the book. The writers wrote the book. I made little links. And then I realised that it was 160,000 words. And my contract, when I looked at it, all the time, spend one's time looking at contracts, was for 80,000 words. Half. They yielded a bit and they said I could have 20,000. Could I cut it down to 100,000? Which I did. So it lost 60,000 words, and they weren't, the vast majority of them were not Y words, they were the words of Irish writers. People say, well, why isn't Michael McCavity in it, for example, Northern Irish writer? And he was. But he and others had to go.
Some of the voices had to go for the purposes of...
Silenced.
of editors. I actually wonder, I remember in the introduction to that book, you say, despite its close links, Ireland is not a quaint variant of England. Mm. And I suspect that if more people in power in England had understood that simple fact, our history might have been very different. You have a lovely poem dedicated to your wife, Kate, which you might read for us.
Ah, you rather take me by surprise here, but okay, fine, and delighted. It's called Thanks. For Kate. Of highest graces which the soul of man can prove brief possession of, thanks and praise are best. The poorest of us rich with life, if little else. Dignum et justum est. Praise and thanks, therefore. They boom inside, a pulse, joy. We peer and stare, surprised to find it there, and little understand. There is one who here is praised for living kindness, sharp as builder's sand, which binds a house together. Containment, also rescue. And that one is you. The glory and the strength is, I thank, therefore I am, a joke you will endure with patience if you can. My genes are in the pun. The strength is in the story. From dailiness, from years, emerges parity. To you belongs the glory, that not before the tomb, now neither knows nor cares, neither gives a damn, so long as the job is done, who has rescued whom?
PJ Kavanagh, you've been a regular columnist and literary critic over the decades with The Spectator and the TLS in particular, and Book of Selected Writings from The Spectator, People and Places, was published some years ago. And in that you observe that writing a column is like being allowed to write a personal letter to the world. Yep. Was it a great joy to write that regular personal letter to the world?
Well, it was marvellous to have what Kate called my pulpit, really. And I could write about anything at all, small or large. And yes, I did enjoy writing it. And I wrote it for about 7 years, once a week. And then for another, I don't know how many years, 10 years, yeah, perhaps, every fortnight. And the only disadvantage was I realised that some of the columns should have been poems. And I couldn't do both at the same time. Other people have said that they couldn't write prose and poems at the same time. Don't ask me why, I don't know. And so in my very last collection of poems, I set some of these prose, well, two or three of these prose columns into verse. But I was aware that it was about 20 years when I was writing these things for money as well as pleasure, that I was, you could say, stifling the muse in myself, but not really in any way. It's not a phrase I've just used it, but it's not a phrase I would use.
Well, I would always feel that writing one thing can help to bolster another, even if it's long term. I mean, yes. the inspiration may be held back a little, but
but the columns. Just we were talking earlier about form. I noticed I read a book called Finding Connections, and the columns always contained. Not planned at all. 2.5 ideas. And the other half, making it 3, was linking the 3 ideas together. And they're making a connection, starting in one place. And sometimes it's very difficult to know where to... people have complained to me, why couldn't I say what I was going to say? Because I'd start on one subject, which didn't interest them at all, and suddenly move from there to another subject, which interested them very much, somebody said to me. And why couldn't he have been told in advance I was going to write about that subject? Well, there you are. He should have read on.
you'd mentioned the novels earlier. As well as being a poet, you've written published several novels over the years and a few novels for children. How did the prose writing, the writing of novels in particular, sit with the poetry, and how do you view those novels now?
Well, they were written really rather a long time ago, and it's just an old man reminiscing, I suppose. But it was rather my younger son, who now is over 40, has suddenly started reading his father's works. And over the last couple of years, I've been getting there and saying, wow, Dad, that's awfully good. And so I reread one of my novels about 6 months ago because of this. Have a look at it. It's called A Happy Man. And I was reading. I had no idea what happened next. None at all. And then suddenly somebody said something. I said, good God, I've never heard anybody say that. And then I realised I'd written it. That long ago.
In the introduction to A Book of Consolations, this compilation of writings, I suppose, in which we may find consolation. You said, every generation seeks to console itself as best it can for doubt, pain, mortality. What do you turn to for consolation now? Is it poetry? Is it literature, nature, family, the possibility of God?
I think it's quality. I was thinking this morning, people are always pressing books into one's hand and you must read this, and my heart always sings. Sometimes, of course, they're right. But not often. I sort of go back. In terms of novels, I tend to reread Dickens, Tolstoy. Yes, Dostoevsky, Turgenev. I don't read much contemporary fiction. And as for poetry, I frequently turn, as I said earlier, to Gerard Manley Hopkins, Henry Vaughan, Marv. They're so different, but I greatly admire their skill and their subject matter, actually, in serious matters of being a human.
So it's a particular quality in writing.
And P.G.
Woodhouse, indeed. Always a consolation. Always a consolation. You'd mentioned that the new edition of Selected Poems, of your Selected Poems, is coming out next year with an introduction by Derek Mahon. I think you feel that Mahon really gets what you do.
Yes, that's why I asked him to write it, and was very. I was asked to find someone to write an introduction, and I immediately thought of Derek because he's reviewed me three or four times, and I thought we're very different. He's a very good poet himself, as well as journalist and prose writer. I've always enjoyed his stuff, although it's not by any means the same as mine. But I always thought he had some idea, or more than some idea, of what I was trying to do. So he was an obvious person to ask, and as I say, he was very pleased to do it.
Can we finish with a poem? And I suppose I'd like it to be a poem of your choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a poem about Dublin. I suppose it needs a little explanation, because it's really certain events which happened in St. Stephen's Green a few years ago, and it needs a correction. It's a very bad idea for any poem to contain a fact. Everybody loves facts, but actually facts disappear and change their faces. And we used to go when we were in Dublin, to Newman's Church, and St. Stephen's Green, a Byzantine church. And he had copied, at his own expense, Raphael's cartoons from the Victorian Albert, I think they are. And in the course of time, they had gone completely black. And yet, year after year, there were these huge black canvases. And these I mention in the poem, and various things that happened in St. Stephen's Green. Well, I was recently in that church, and the black canvases had been taken away and have been replaced by very garish substitutes. But what they could have done with the black canvases, I don't know. And the poem is called Something About. And it's one of those titles that form part of the first line, and the pun about something about. Something about those huge black canvases in Newman's Church, St. Stephen's Green. Restoration botched, perhaps. Raphael cartoons, copies, loved by Newman, quite gone out. Something about outside, Joyce's head, too silver sharp, too shrunk, facing stone steps he argued up, of the house where Hopkins sweated, found his heart, his shaping billet, turned, widow of an insight lost, which we know something about. Something about a pigeon flight above the little lake, dark, then white, as they turn as one bird and repeat, black into white, as ruined paint will not. 9 times precisely, and like one bird depart. Strange the fate, insight spoiled, wanting rhymes too neat, whichever way we think, wherever look, to snuffle like setters in a winter garden, excitedly nosing old leaves, mortally certain there is, certainly was, night's odorous traffic, something, somewhere, about.
And thanks to PJ Kavanagh, our guest on Arts Tonight. PJ Kavanagh's new selected poems will be published by Carcanet Press, and many of his recent collections and his collected poems are also in print. That's it from us. Back again next week at the same time. Till then, good night.